On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the FBI peels the onion, Dell goes solo, we talk about the future of networking, and yes, it's a geek in a box. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 58, recorded September 16th, 2013. Dell is the new IBM. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, a powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with coworkers and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even present from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit techserve.com/twiet and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not guiding you alone. I'm joined by my super stellar cast of characters, starting with Mr. Brian Chi from the University of Hawaii, the SOAST School. Brian, how are you? How are things for the geek in paradise?
Well, I am doing just dandy. And you know what? I'm actually starting to ramp up a mini maker fair in Hawaii. I'm just trying to get the venue set. There's an amazing amount of moving parts when it goes to put on a show. And, you know, maybe I can twist a few arms and do a mini Maker Faire Twit special.
I don't think we would mind. But, of course, I would have to come out and join you for that to be possible.
Dude,
yes.
Dude, you're always welcome.
Absolutely fantastic. Speaking of welcome, we welcome our second panelist. You know him. You love him. He's our man in the enterprise, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, thank you for coming back. I know you're in Florida. You're on the other coast. You know, we've got the United States covered. Tell me, how are you today?
It is a beautiful day down here in the swamp, enjoying what passes for cool, balmy fall temperatures, only about 89 degrees and about that much humidity. So we're cool, calm, and collected, and we're just grateful to have Twiet to spend a Monday afternoon.
Speaking of cool, calm, and collected, why not get straight into our first Enterprise Byte? Now, this one is a doozy. The FBI has admitted to, well, using the Tor system against itself to distribute malware. Now, this stems from the seizure of Freedom Hosting. If you haven't heard of Freedom Hosting was one of these large data center, data service operations that basically said, you rent your server from us, and we don't ever look. We don't care what's on the server. All we know is that you rented your space, you've rented your traffic. Interesting operation, but the reason why it was located outside of the United States is because that actually does run afoul of some U.S. laws. Now, the FBI secretly took control of Freedom Hosting on July 12th off of a child porn charge. They stated that the servers at Freedom Hosting were being used to traffic child pornography. Now, that's actually very, very possible. In fact, we know that's more than just possible. There was child pornography located on some of Freedom Hosting servers, and that's what the FBI moved on. But here's what they did. Rather than saying to the world that they had taken over Freedom Hosting, they stayed mum about it. They indicted the operator, who was Eric Marquez, currently in Dublin trying to fight extradition back to the United States, and they used those servers to distribute malware onto computers that were connecting to Freedom Hosting servers through Tor. That's the Onion Router network. It's the network that tries to guarantee guarantee anonymity. Now, we have to do a quick tutorial on Tor for you to understand how this works. It's not just regular encryption. Yes, there's encryption, but it's encryption in layers. The way that Tor works is you've got several thousand volunteer nodes or relays through which traffic can pass. And it passes through multiple layers of these nodes, bouncing back and forth, back and forth. Each time it does that, each time it goes from layer to layer, it only knows the destination of the next relay that it needs to go to. That means that it pretty much guarantees anonymity. It's difficult to track someone when you go through enough layers of the onion router. What they did was they bypassed that. Rather than trying to crack the encryption of the Tor system, they installed via a vulnerability in Firefox into the Tor bundle that some people were using, a plugin that essentially reported the real IP address of the end user's computer. With that real IP address, the FBI could then look up individuals who were in the United States, show up with a warrant, and seize computers. Now, this, from the law enforcement perspective, is a pretty open and shut case. They took over a distributor of a known illegal product. They basically created a sting that allowed them to find the actual identities of the people who were perpetrating the crime, and then they arrested them. But to people in enterprise circles, this is sending out a lot of ripples. Chibert, let's start with you. Why is this such an interesting story for those people who are worried about enterprise security?
Well, because it involves malware. You know, it now, on the FBI's defense, they were modifying a plugin that was doing in what in their mind is quasi-illegal. It's the plugin that allows you to bounce around through all these different nodes. But it involves modifying a person's machine without their knowledge and without an explicit warrant. So this starts getting into some really thin ice on whether or not that original warrant covered this much ground. Definitely something we probably want to talk about on something like Twill.
Right, right. Curtis, let me go over to you because this actually is a very important question. In this era where more and more crime that we're going after, the more serious crime, is it has some sort of electronic, some cyber component to it. The laws haven't caught up yet, and the FBI has been lamenting this, the NSA has been lamenting this, that it's becoming more and more difficult for them to do their job because people can hide behind things like Tor, behind encryption. And so they would argue, look, this is just another tool in our toolbox. We didn't force them to go to these servers to download child pornography. It's just that when they did, their computers were infected. From the enterprise side, we count on things like encryption to keep us safe, especially in light of some recent government efforts to make sure that they could read everything. What would it do to the enterprise community if suddenly we started thinking, no, encryption is safe. It doesn't matter where you store it. Everything could always be read.
Well, let's remember that the heart of this particular exploit wasn't a break in the encryption. The heart of this was a social engineering hack. And that's what virtually every real security professional I know of fears the most. You know, the fact is that our encryption is pretty good if we indeed use the strong encryption that's available to us. Our firewalls are pretty good. Our security systems are pretty good. What is much less effective is the training that we're giving users and the fear that we are giving users that what they do can have an impact on their livelihood and the existence of the entire organization. When you get right down to it, the human beings are the weakest link. And so to me, what this tells security professionals is that it's time to redouble the effort on training, on education, and on constant reinforcement of just what it means to be secure. You know, we laugh about all of the posters that went up back during World War I and World War II about the enemy that was lurking just around the corner. But I think it's probably time for something like that to be tried in today's enterprise. Let people know that every email they get could be something that will harm them and the organization, and that they need to treat enclosures, attachments, anything that's not simple text in the message as a potential liability for the organization.
Good point. Very good point. I do want to take a comment from the chat room from Nerve, who writes, regardless of the comments, I'm glad that they caught the child porn traffickers. Now, here's something that's actually a very good point. You know, there was a crime being committed. Where I think it runs afoul of the sensibilities of the enterprise slash hacker slash geek community is it's too easy to point out the worst thing that's happening in a system and say this is why we needed this measure to defeat the system, because who can be for child pornographers? There's no one who's for child pornographers. No one will defend a child pornographer. However, what if the focus then switches to, well, we saw some financial crime. We saw what could have been some illegal transactions. We saw some communications that maybe might have led to a crime down the road. It's the slippery slope analogy. Once you start doing this, where do you stop? Where do you draw the line and say, okay, that crime is no longer important enough for us to break people's basic right to privacy? But Chibert, there is a nuance here, right? I mean, because I think one of the fears of many people who use the Tor system was that somehow an agency, the government, or some hackers would be able to compromise either the entry point or the endpoints, the end relays of the Tor network. It's that whole idea of inserting yourself into the network so that you can gather enough information to be able to suss out people's anonymity. But that didn't happen here, right? I mean, the encryption worked. The Tor system worked. The vulnerability was elsewhere.
Yeah, totally. This, you know, if you grab the data before it even goes into the encryptor, you haven't broken the encryption. You just grabbed it before it went in. And that's one of the reasons why in the government, why we spent so much time and effort guarding the unencrypted side. And hell, when I had encrypted links, I used to have Marines guarding the conduits as the concrete around the conduits dried, because I didn't want someone sticking a listening device in there. The same thing happened with Tor. If you get the data before it's encrypted, that's not breaking encryption.
All right. I think this is something that we're going to see more and more as encryption gets stronger and stronger, especially with everything that was revealed about Prism, about the NSA spying. People are getting serious about encryption. And there are actually companies out there that are now making encryption easy. We have a vendor here on the Twit TV network, ProXPN. I actually use their service from time to time, and they make VPNing dead easy. But I think what people don't remember is it doesn't matter if you encrypt your data if either of the endpoints is not protected. Chibert, let me talk to you really quickly, because we're going to be doing a VPN special. We've been planning this for a while. We're bringing in a couple of vendors to actually show people how you can set up a VPN for enterprise, for Soho, for personal use. There is this mythos around VPN that once I've got the VPN running, I'm good. I don't have to worry about anything else. Just let it flow. But there is another element there, right? I mean, you have to worry about personal security. You have to worry about premise security so that when data gets from one side of the encrypted tunnel to the other, it's still protected. When do you think we start getting a rise in awareness of that issue?
Well, it's a lot of it is because we trust encryption. You know, actually, one of the concepts is the trusted interface in a lot of firewalls. So if you're making a connection from, say, a branch office, let's use an example of Panda Express. Panda Express uses VPNs to link their register systems at all their branch offices, all the mall delis that we go to, back to the regional office. They literally have thousands and thousands of VPNs set up. But those registers are trusted because everything that comes through is assumed to be trusted. Now, what a lot of people are starting to do now that the firewalls and VPN devices are capable, they're actually calling VPNs, each individual VPN, a different zone so that you can actually examine the data and have less trust. So the point is, just because you have a VPN doesn't mean you don't have antivirus, because an infected laptop at a home on a VPN is still going to be able to get in and infect the enterprise. Right. So it's all a matter of layers, layers, layers. Never trust a single layer. Always do defense in depth.
Now, you and I are hardware guys. We really like the hardware. We really like the gear. But I want to give Curtis the last word here because he brought up a very important point, and that is changing the mindset that goes on before and after the encryption. We've got a comment from Nerv in the chat room. Again, Nerv, you're on fire today. He says, in many ways, it's defeatist to divert attention to encryption. There is absolute value in encryption, and the awareness is a positive outcome. But we must tackle the problem from the source to simply dilute the NSA and its questionable activities. This is one of these things that I actually got on a soapbox during the whole Prism reveal. And that is, look, you got to realize that anything you send over an open network is probably going to be looked at. Even if you encrypt it, if you put it out on the internet, if you send it from one endpoint to another, it's as if you're on a street corner yelling it out into the public. We don't really get that in the enterprise, right? I know specifically when I've spoken to executives, they just assume that the tech guys are going to figure out a way to make their communication secure.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And what's more important is that in this case, the particular lever that the government used to go after this was child pornography. They can use that same lever on any organization that they suspect might have child pornography files living on its servers. And let me tell you, there are tons of organizations out there that have been compromised, perhaps in a branch office, perhaps in an old part of a data center, perhaps in a manufacturing facility where the attention to security has not been as high. If people have gone in and broken that security, the odds are pretty good that they are using the server space they find as a relay point for child pornography or illegally held copyright files. In either of those cases, a law enforcement agency can use that suspicion to go in, use a similar attack, and essentially try to open the electronic books of the entire organization. That's the possibility that really has a lot of enterprise folks scared. And that's why they really want to be in there training their users. You know, people like Cheebert and I have been beating the drum to train the users for more than a decade. The message still hasn't gotten through. You still have some organizations that seem to be able to do it right, but those are in a distinct minority. Most organizations still take far too trusting a view over on what the hardware people can do regarding their security. Believe me, the best hardware in the world can't overcome a weak human in the entire transaction.
And I think we have a show title, Weak Humans. Now, I know we could go on forever on this topic, and we're going to have to come back and revisit it because there are implications anytime we talk about security, anytime we talk about monitoring of supposedly secure communications and secure data streams, it's going to have huge ramifications for networking, for cloud storage, for cloud services. So we'll definitely be back. But before that, we do want to drop into our second enterprise bite of the day. Again, it's interesting to have two major pieces of news in a week. This one is Dell going private. We have expected this for a while. This broke months and months ago, but the deal is finally done, at least as done as a deal can get before money is actually exchanged. Now, it's worth $24.9 billion. The equity was put up by Michael Dell himself and Silver Lake Partners. It's an equity firm. Shareholders will be paid $13.88 per share plus an 8-cent per share dividend for the third quarter of the fiscal year. Now, this is just a few cents over the current market value of the stock, so there isn't much of a buyout premium. Interesting to note is that Carl Icahn, you know him. You know him. Some of you love him. Some of you hate him. Really fought this. He thought that the shareholder should get more value. Specifically, he thought he should get more value out of his shares. He was looking at the original a purchase price of $24.5 billion, and he thought that should be doubled. Well, of course, that didn't happen. It's just a tiny tick above the original asking price. So let me throw this over to you first, Curtis. This has got to be seen as a win for Michael Dell, right? To move $500 million over his original purchase offer, that's pretty much spot on.
Oh, absolutely. I think that basically Michael got what he wanted. And I suspect, I have no direct knowledge of this, but I suspect it's solidly within the price range that he thought he was going to have to pay. You know, the big thing that Michael gets from this is the ability to remake the company in the image that he thinks it needs to be cast in. The PC market is a race to the bottom. And Dell has no interest in winning that race. Instead, he wants to be able to take it in an enterprise direction. If you look at the acquisitions Dell has made over the past 2 or 3 years, they are all going in the direction of making Dell an end-to-end enterprise provider. The problem is that in order to do this, at some level, he has to be able to commit to that strategy, which means stepping away from the PC business. At the moment, the PC business still provides an awful lot of cash coming in. That means there are going to be a few rocky quarters from a shareholder standpoint. Michael is willing to go through that rocky time. The vast majority of shareholders weren't. He solved that problem, and I think the result is going to be a company that is much better positioned to make it as an enterprise player going forward.
Right. Actually, you bring up a really good point, and that is the ability to weather those rocky quarters. I'm sure our audience knows this, but for those who maybe have not been so hip and savvy on business dealings, when you take a company private, like Michael Dell is doing with Dell, you no longer have a responsibility to your shareholders. You are essentially the shareholder. He will have a responsibility to the private equity firm, but I believe the stipulations in the agreement is that Dell is the captain of the ship. He can take the company any way he wants. He doesn't have to always make decisions for the company based on the next quarter, on the next performance, on the next dividend. He can now look 2, 3, 5 years down the line and say, this is where I want Dell to be. We're going to have to cut out all this fat. It's going to lose us a lot of profit, a lot of revenue in the short term, but I believe it's going to make us revenue in the long term. Now, oddly enough, that's one of the reasons why Dell was able to get the purchase at the price that he wanted. We found that in May 2013, Dell reported a 79% slide in profit. So revenue stayed more or less stagnant. You see Dell between $12 and $15 billion a quarter, but the profit margins dropped off. And again, that's what Curtis mentioned in the race to the bottom. The margins of the PC business are just falling through the floor. Dell is very dependent on PC sales, but what we've seen is that enterprise has taken up a consistent third of the revenue. So if it was $15 billion, enterprise was worth $5 billion. And within that chunk of the enterprise, the PC slice of that $5 billion has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking as the margin shrinks. And the services and server side has been growing. So, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you. Where do you see Dell positioning itself? And obviously, it wants to grow that enterprise side. It wants to grow the part of the business that makes much larger margins. So if Michael Dell now has free reign, if he can plan for 5 years down the road, where would you want Dell to position itself to properly serve its enterprise consumers in 5 years?
Well, I'm going to shine up the crystal ball a little bit. And keep in mind, the East Asian market has been absolutely famous for 5 and 10 year plans. I used to be an engineer for Fujitsu Limited Japan, and we all had to march the tune of the same drum, and that was a 5 year plan. And this was for mainframe clones, for God's sakes. Now, what I think Michael Dell's trying to do is trying not to make the mistake that people like IBM have done. IBM stopped innovating quite a while ago. And now when all of a sudden the market disappeared out from under them, and oh my God, we got to play catch up. I think Michael Dell's trying to avoid having to get into this catch up game by setting out a 5-10 year plan and putting more money into innovation. I think things are going to change radically at Dell. I have quite a few friends at various divisions that have been bought by Dell. And we're starting to see more money going into development. And I just think that Dell's going to have some real interesting surprises, especially in the enterprise arena, where enterprise is their cash cow.
Right. A lot of people have not realized, and we've been reporting it from time to time, Dell has gone on an absolute buying spree in the last 18 months. They've bought big players like SonicWall, so they now have a security/router side. They've bought several thin client type companies, so now they have the ability to push out their services from their data centers that they're also building, they've been partnering with. What are some of the other big acquisitions that Dell has made over the last, say, year and a half?
Quest. Quest got bought. I'm not sure that was a great one, but I think it's because they have a lot of really good services in development. They're trying to buy the IP. Dell Weiss, obviously. In fact, Dell Weiss is starting to make noise about an Android-based thin client in the $50 range, which is absolutely stunning, especially considering they have a system on a chip on those things, so they'll be able to do the thin client very, very quickly with a lot of high-resolution video. After that, I'm going to have to go do a Google search because, man, these guys have been on a buying spree, and they're buying technology, and the technology is all enterprise.
Right, right. Let me throw back over to you, Curtis, because this is an interesting view into the future for Dell. We say that Michael can now take it the way he wants, but I think he's already shown his hand. He, in just the purchases Dell has already made, he can now go to an executive. He can go to a CTO. He can go to a CEO and say, listen, we can give you everything from the workstations in your office to the laptops that your workers carry, to the thin clients you have in your remote offices, to the firewalls and the routers that will run between them, to the data center that's going to store all your information in a private cloud, to the management software that you're going to need to be able to control all of it at a glance. That's appealing, right? I mean, if one vendor can come to you and say, look, we'll give you the whole thing, end-to-end business services, that's something that definitely has to be dealt with, yes?
Oh, it absolutely has to be dealt with. And you left out two pieces that I think may be even more important than the technology that you mentioned. Dell can also go to that enterprise customer and say, we will be your private cloud provider. We will provide the off-premise private cloud for you. And we will provide the management and integration for what you're doing. It happened long enough ago that most people forget that Dell bought EDS. Dell has some pretty big investments in system integration and system management. And I suspect, I have no direct knowledge, but I suspect that that's really the business that Michael Dell would love to see grow. If you want to see the kind of company that Dell would love to be, look at IBM. IBM is a services company that happens to make some hardware and sell some software. I think that Michael Dell would love to see his company follow that path, get a lot of its ongoing revenue from the services side where the margins can be quite respectable, and continuing, and take the reliance on hardware and software back to a much more manageable level.
Dell is the new IBM. I think that's the new show title. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking all about the future of networking, how one of the foundational technologies of every piece of networking gear that you use today is changing, and it's changing for the better. But before that, I want to take some time to talk about the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot, and of course, that's Citrix and GoToMeeting. Now, we know that meetings are essential to the way that we work. It's how we interact. It's how we share ideas. It's how we problem solve. You need to be face-to-face with the person that you're working with or that you're selling a service to in order to figure out exactly what it is they need, what it is they want, what it is that you can do to make things better. It's an opportunity to share and to grow. But what happens when meetings become more difficult to do, when you're in different locations, different offices, different floors, different buildings, different cities, different countries? coming together can be an almost impossible task. That is, unless you use GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate online. With GoToMeeting, you can be away from the office and still stay connected to your coworkers and clients. Over the past few months, you've probably heard me extol the virtues of GoToMeeting more than a few times. And yet, it never gets old for me because it's a product that I actually use. I enjoy talking about it because, well, it makes my life that much easier. You see, I'm not just a spokesman for GoToMeeting. I am an honest-to-goodness customer. My work has me meeting with many people across the world each and every single month. Now, I used to have to jump into a plane every time I wanted to meet, but that got expensive and the wear and tear on my body just wasn't worth it. With GoToMeeting, we have the ability to share documents. We have the ability to see each other in HD, which means that we can see that slightly raised eyebrow. We can see when someone is getting it and when someone needs more explanation. GoToMeeting saved my life, literally, my sanity, my health, and my company tons of money. I love GoToMeeting. It's easy to use, and with HD Faces, it's just like meeting in person. Now, no matter where everyone is located, GoToMeeting allows you to share the same screen, making it easier to be on the same page. You can turn on your webcam to see each other face-to-face in HD video, and it's so easy to launch or join a meeting from anywhere using your computer, phone, or tablet. That's right. You can even present from your iPad. How's that for mobility? So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting and see if it will be as useful to you as it is for me. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember, use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing, and we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to it. Before we run the video, Chibert, we need to know some basics about networking. And specifically, we need to know about spanning tree. What is spanning tree?
Spanning tree is a method that actually allows you to have redundant paths. So say, for instance, you're trying to run cables between two departments. You can actually run multiple cables, connect the two switches together, and it won't create a bridge loop. Now, let's explain a bridge loop. If you take a standard plain vanilla El Cheapo Best Buy switch and you take a cable, you plug one port into another, within a couple of seconds, you're going to notice that the activity lights on your switch are going to skyrocket and go solid. This is called a bridge loop. Now, if you want redundant paths between switches, you need something like spanning tree so that you can have these redundant paths but not create bridge loops. So spanning tree to the rescue. Spanning tree has actually gone through multiple iterations. It's now called fast spanning tree, and there's a lot of different variations. But the idea is to prevent bridge loops from happening and also the ability to give you multiple paths, multiple physical paths between switch, multiple redundant paths. Now, spanning tree is starting to get less and less popular, especially for things like redundant paths. I actually really like LACP, Link Aggregation Protocol, which is nice because you can also do this at the server level. So instead of having a single 1 gig link, I can have multiple gig links. But that's a topic for another show.
Right. I think the important takeaway is that spanning tree really forms the foundation of what we do in enterprise networking today. It's how we connect switches together and ultimately users to servers to devices. But there's something coming, something new, something faster, something a little bit better, and that's what we're going to bring you in this edition of the Data Closet. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, host of TWiET, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the TWiET Network. I'm here at Interop Las Vegas 2013 at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center, and I have the pleasure of sitting next to Steve Emmerich from Avaya. You're a systems engineer, network engineer, network architect engineer. You're all those sorts of things.
Something like that, yeah. My title is a network solutions architect for Avaya.
I like that better. And you're here for an episode of the Data Closet. This time we're going to be talking about shortest path bridging.
Perfect.
Now, Steve, what is shortest path bridging?
Shortest path bridging is a new protocol. It's an IEEE rote protocol that was ratified last March, something called 802.1AQ. great standards, numbers, and everything. Yeah. But what does that mean to somebody? What shortest path bridging is, it's a new way of creating a network fabric that extends throughout the campus, throughout the enterprise.
Okay, I get it. So in a traditional network, we would have a series of switches that use protocols like, for example, spanning. To jump from switch to switch to switch. You would hop from switch to switch to get to your destination. Shortest path bridging sounds like I don't have to do that anymore. I could see all my switches as a single unit.
You got it, exactly. Shortest path bridging is a replacement for spanning tree. We've been using spanning tree for nearly 30 years now, and we've been trying to extend it as an industry, but you know, it's really reached its limits.
Now, I know my audience, and my audience is going to say, hey, enough of the marketing stuff. Tell me what it can do. So let's get to brass tacks. What does shortest path bridging allow me to do in my network that I couldn't previously do?
By eliminating spanning tree, typically, if you think of the way we've been doing networking, spanning tree as a layer two type of mechanism to avoid loops. So we've gotten rid of the spanning tree loop prevention protocol. We've gotten rid of potentially OSPF as a layer three protocol on top of it. We've converged those two together with the protocol that shortest path bridging uses, which is ISIS, which is a protocol that's very extensible. It's been used in the carrier world for a number of years.
What would be different about looking at, say, an Avaya Fabric network versus a traditional network using spanning tree and dozens of switches?
Well, again, the simplicity. So what you could expect, a good example is what we're doing in the InteropNet. We have the show floor pedestals, which have VLANs that the exhibitor is attached to. And that's conventional networking. From that point on, we have the shortest path bridging fabric that runs from those pedestals, the show floor distribution switches, to a network core. And at that point, we hand off to conventional protocols, again, OSPF. That gives me the ability to take a look at it from a single hop perspective. Instead of the normal network that we would have had here of having several hops from that pedestal to a distribution layer to the show floor, or to the core rather, it is seen as one hop all the way through. So I've simplified and flattened that network.
I got it. Okay, so for example, I'm going to use Interop as an example here. Mm-hmm. To go from, say, the show floor to a client, let's say someone in a classroom who's trying to access a demo on the show floor, you'd have to hop from that client into the rack peds, into the core, down to distribution, maybe up to another switch that is feeding a classroom, then maybe even to a further switch that's inside the classroom before you get to the client. You're saying with shortest path bridging, you would hop from show floor to client.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
If you were to do, for example, a trace route, you'd see the ingress router and then an egress, one hop.
Let's turn this around a little bit, because I'm sure the engineers are going to want to know, that sounds great, but what are the drawbacks? So what are the challenges of implementing a shortest path bridging network?
Obviously, it is an interaction with existing protocols. The cool part about it is, it's interoperable. It's an IEEE standard. It's actually an IETF standard as well. So I mentioned already being able to attach at the edge using standard VLANs. We do that. So we have that backwards compatibility with 802.1Q VLAN tagging and everything we do at the edge. We also have the ability, because we're using that ISIS protocol throughout the cloud to provide a link state database, it provides all of the characteristics of a routed protocol, but running at layer two. What that gives me is the ability to hand off to OSPF, whether I want to do it conventionally, because I can import routes from the conventional OSPF network into ISIS and vice versa. And that gives me that full capability to interoperate and create, if you will, islands of shortest path bridging that I can start expanding if and when or as the customer wants to see it.
Well, that answers my next question, and that is, how would this work in the real world? Because in the real world, we're not all going to fork out all our switches and replace them with, say, Avaya's fabric switches, which are equipped with shortest path bridging. What you're saying is I can start with a core and then sort of grow that until I have replaced all my switches. And in the meantime, the edge of that Avaya cloud, of that Avaya fabric, will speak all the traditional protocols. So
absolutely,
all the switches I have in place, they see one big switch, but it still speaks the same language as a traditional switch.
Yep, exactly. That's the point.
I like that. Now, if they want to find out more about Avaya fabric or shortest path bridging, where should they go?
You can get a lot of resources on the internet. Most especially, we have a lot of white papers and information at avaya.com/networking.
Steve, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Padre.
And you stay tuned, because we've got more. This has been an episode of the Data Closet.
Now, Avaya calls their technology Avaya Fabric, their shortest path bridging. But all vendors, all major vendors, are working on some form of this technology where you can see all the switches in your network, all the switches in your enterprise as one big switch. So rather than having to configure the hops that jump between switches and routers, you instead have servers and you have clients. And that's pretty much it. Chibert, why is this so attractive to engineers?
Oh, dude, it's a natural. Instead of having, say, for instance, a collection of 124 port switches that are scattered all over my enterprise, now I manage it as if it was a single 24 whatever the math is switch. I can manage my switching as a single entity. It's very, very cool. It allows me to move my VLANs around so that if I have a VLAN that's for admin and admin happens to be in three or four buildings, I can pop it out just where I need it. And I don't have to worry about routing. I don't have to worry about all kinds of stuff. In fact, it's such a big change that the open networking guys are, that's part and parcel is what it is. Being able to manage multiple devices as a single device is a really, really big deal.
Spawn in the chat room brings up one of the things I was trying to get to, which is he says, so one mistake and it all comes down. And that's, yes, if you made one bad enough mistake, you could bring the whole thing down. But a well-implemented solution actually won't let you make that mistake. Curtis, I want to throw over to you. Something else that I talked about in the interview is this idea of being able to gradually replace your network. I think one of the items that needs to be sold to executives is, well, why would I replace my network if it's working just fine? Because this technology is compatible with current network switches, with spanning tree, you could actually build out from the core. You could replace the switches and the routers at the core of your enterprise and then slowly go out as equipment starts to fail. That's actually a big deal, right? Because it's not a forklift upgrade. It's more of a pot and pan and little bits here and there upgrade.
That's true. It allows you to do an incremental upgrade, and that's important from several viewpoints. One of them, of course, is financial. You can spread your capital expenses over a number of years. That's a very good thing. The other thing that technologists can bring to the conversation, though, when the bean counters, when the executives say, well, why should we worry about the network at all today? I went to get my email and it worked just fine. Is something that came from Malcolm Gladwell, and that's the notion of the tipping point. TCP/IP networks are wonderful creatures that tend to be beautifully efficient up to a magic point. And when you reach that point, that tipping point in terms of usage and saturation, the performance falls off a cliff. What you want to make sure is that your network never comes close to that tipping point. You can do that in a controlled, incremental fashion through this technology rolled out over time, making sure that your network infrastructure is always one important step ahead of your user base.
I like that. I like that. Thank you. That's good words. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking all about data centers in a box. May they be not just the source of your next server, your next data storage cluster, but your power, too. But before that, I want to take time to talk about the second sponsor of the Twilight Right, and that is RingCentral. Now, when Leo built the studio, he decided to do as much as possible in the cloud. It's what we tell people to do. We've been telling them to get into the cloud, to get their services, their document sharing, their email, everything possible into a cloud-based platform. So when Russell, our IT guy, came to us and told us that we could have a full-featured phone system, a PBX-like phone system without the bulky PBX hardware in the basement, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs and no hardware to install, no lines to maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling with ease. Our producers get their voicemail through their email, and we can even get our fax messages right on our smartphones. RingCentral will also give you your own auto receptionist. Greet your callers, announce employees and department extensions. Getting calls after hours, no problem. RingCentral will route your calls to your smartphone's phone service center or voicemail. Have clients on hold? You can type a message in real time and have it translated from text to speech and delivered to your caller while they wait. Just one of the things that RingCentral continues to develop to make your phone service more next-gen. Now, here's what they've got. You see, RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you can get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, just in case it didn't go through the Tor router properly, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let's get to it. We're going to be talking about data centers in a box. But first, we have a errata to be reported by Curtis Franklin that came from earlier in our discussion from Enterprise Byte One. Curtis, you mismentioned a company that was bought by Dell. Let's correct it just so that we don't get any of the voicemail slash email I told you so's.
Yeah, and I want to give a big shout out to the chat room. They called this to my attention almost immediately. Dell did not buy EDS. HP actually bought EDS. Dell bought Perot Systems. Of course, Perot was the gentleman who founded EDS, sold it off, then later founded Perot Systems. Dell bought Perot Systems, not EDS. My apologies for the misstatement.
And also apologies to Dell, because if you Googled for EDS, you'd find an interesting history. Now let's get to it. We're talking about data centers in a box. T-Bert, this is something that we've been playing with for a while. The idea of being able to pack a lot of servers, a lot of processing power into a shippable container has been attractive to geeks. The ability to have servers on demand, data centers on demand, is just very, very cool. But for the longest time, it was sort of the realm of the Uber geek. No real practical use until we started seeing some of the major players adopt this. We saw it from Microsoft. We saw it from Google. We saw it from Sun. We saw it from Yahoo. The military has been doing data centers in a box for a decade or more. Now, we have a story here from Forbes that talks about how data centers could possibly be good for the grid, how you could leverage the equipment that's installed in a data center to regulate the power on an electrical grid, specifically when you hit those peak times, those times when the grid isn't producing enough power or the power generators aren't spun up. It would be nice to be able to pull energy back from data centers, which have to admittedly store a crazy huge amount of power to keep their servers running properly. Now, so what we see is this confluence of portable data centers, of data centers that can be dropped anywhere, and the next generation power grid. Tell me a little bit about why those two should come together.
Well, look at it this way. Data centers, because of their nature, we tend to have a lot of power conditioning equipment because we want nice, clean power for our machines. But as time has gone on, there's more and more reliability and flexibility built into the servers themselves so that we can handle a little bit of things outside the norm. The concept that the Forbes magazine article is talking about is to use the power conditioning capability of a modern data center so that a power company may or may not always have the capacity of power that has been conditioned. So when you go and have your feed from the typical power company, you want, say, 120 volts at 60 hertz, and you don't want it to vary a whole lot. But the trick is the power coming out of the generation plants is not that even. It has to go through a lot of harmonic conditioners. It has to go through a lot of conditioning equipment, which is very, very expensive. It's hard to deploy, and the power company is never caught up. So the concept here is, gee, we've got the power conditioning in the data center. Why not work it out so that we can feed slightly dirtier power to the data centers, and we'll discount it? because now the power company doesn't have to spend quite so much on harmonic conditioning equipment. Makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like, it's not a great analogy, but it's an analogy of why golf courses use gray water to water the greens. You know, instead of having to spend that extra money to make it potable water, why not just, you know, use some gray water? Right. So maybe that's the title, gray water electricity.
Gray water power. One of the analogies that was given to me was how large ships can actually run on different types of fuel, all the way up to some of the really high sulfur content, nasty crude. It's cheaper, but the engines that are built into these large container ships can work it on it just as fine as it would on some of the more refined stuff. If you could do the same thing for your data center, give them the power that would otherwise blow up regular businesses and homes, why wouldn't you do that? If the power conditioning equipment built into a data center can already handle that power, why would you need to feed it clean power? Now, Curtis, I want to go over to you because, of course, you're our expert in the enterprise. You're our expert in cost and ROI. Does this sound like it would be appealing to enterprise executives? We've got a company here in the barrier called Steam that will use a series of switches, very fast-acting switches, and their own proprietary algorithms to buy power from the grid when it's really cheap, to power buildings off the battery backups when it's not so cheap, and maybe in the future even to sell it back into the grid when it's good for them to return power and balance out the overall grid. If there could be some sort of cost savings, do you think that this is something that would be moved on the executive level? We know that power is one of the largest costs for any data center. Data centers are expensive. They use up a lot of power, not just for powering servers, but also for cooling. If a power company could say, hey, look, we can give you 20% off of your power bill over the course of the next 10 years if you agree to sell us back power or take this dirty power, do you think that's an easy sell?
I think it's a possible sell, but when you start looking at power at that level, you start to have to do some fairly sophisticated calculations, because let's be clear here. Nothing's free. If you try to clean up dirty power, the efficiency goes down. I mean, that dirty power does not just magically transmogrify into clean, perfect power. It has to go through a number of steps that may involve rectification, may involve all sorts of transformation, switching. And every time it goes through one of those stages, something is lost. The efficiency is not 100%. It's generally lost to something that we all know, like heat. And so the question for the people who own the data centers is this. If I'm getting, to use your example, a 20% discount on the power coming in, is my loss in efficiency less than 20%, so that I do end up to the net positive in the entire transaction? I don't know. I haven't looked at these systems closely enough to tell you the answer, but I can tell you that that's the sort of thought process that the enterprise data center engineers are going to go through when they have to advise the executives on whether or not this is a great idea. On the one hand, it sounds stunningly good. As with so many things, the devil is in those nasty little details.
Now, let's get down and dirty with containerized data centers. This, again, as we introduce it, this is one of those things that we've been wanting to play with for a while, but now they're actually getting traction. It's good to remind us that these things actually exist. We've got a decent video here that Jason can hopefully play over the top that shows one of Google's facilities for containerized data centers. The important thing to note here is that it's not as if they just took the container off the back of a truck and they dropped it in the middle of a field. This is actually a site that has been prepped. It's got water, it's got cooling, it's got power, it's got, you know, facility security. they can then park about 45 of these containers within the facility and provide it with power, provide it with cooling, et cetera, et cetera. The advantage is you get a smaller footprint, you get a stackable footprint, and you actually get the ability to move these from location to location. That's huge when you talk about flexibility of your build out. Now, these particular containers were confirmed by Google back in 2009. It's a project that they started in 2005. Each shipping container could hold almost 1,200 servers, and they used about 200 to 250 kilowatts of power per container. Their prototype data center in a box housing facility could generate 10 megawatts of power, powering up to 45 of these containers, and also providing the cooling that you would need to make sure that the containers don't eat themselves. Now, Chibert, let me throw over to you. Looking at this facility, looking at what has gone into it, where's the cost savings here? I mean, if they're still building a facility, why wouldn't they just build a facility with racks? Why would they want to use containers?
Well, keep in mind, what's happening here is you're building a facility designed for the machines, not for people. Think about that for a second. If you need to make it comfortable for people, that means you end up spending a lot more money on infrastructure. So one of the things that you got to keep in mind is I was taking a really hard look at this. There's a place on the University of Hawaii campus that absolutely no one wants to be, and that's right next to the main power vault for the university. We were actually proposing that we stack up a whole bunch of these things so we can take the power directly from that power vault. In addition, it was right next door to a very large cooling facility that's only really used during baseball games. Why not use the excess capacity and put it someplace else? And keep in mind, the whole concept of integrated lights out, ILO, DRAC, IPMI, and so forth, means you don't have to physically visit it anymore. So it can be less convenient to get in, and a container is a heck of a lot cheaper than even tilt-up concrete walls for a warehouse-like installation. So we can expand it, we can tear it down, we can build it very, very cheaply and very modularly. In fact, in a lot of places, the containers are so cheap that container yards want to give them away because they're taking up too much space.
Right. Curtis, let me throw over to you, because I think there's an interesting enterprise angle here when we talk about flexibility. I have seen containerized data centers pop up in situations that required first responders. We actually used a containerized data center in Haiti after the big earthquake. The Society of Jesus needed to set up a response center, and so we happened to have access to a container that we were able to drop, get power, get wireless communications up and running within about a 10-mile radius, and we actually had the equipment there to be able to run logistics for support. But it's not just first responder type stuff, right? I mean, anytime you have an event, you have a major sporting event, NASCAR, Super Bowl, it would be wonderful to be able to drop one of these things, hook up power, hook up water, hook up a little bit of cooling, and get on-premise storage, on-premise services that you would otherwise have to get over an internet connection. Is this something that's even on the radar of most enterprise execs? Do they know that this is possible? Do they know that this is something that they could ask for if required?
I would say that most enterprise executives know that it exists. They're aware that they could ask for it because their enterprise vendors have let them know about it. This is something that most of the major system vendors have available. And to be honest, most of them have advanced since that 2009 footage that we were seeing. For example, I know that Dell was showing one last year at Dell World in Austin, a containerized thing that ran on 100% ambient cooled server. So you didn't have to worry about any external cooling systems. All you needed was power and connectivity, and you had a data center. The thing is, the vendors are selling these not so much as emergency facilities, although that's a very natural way to look at deploying them, but as the future of data center design. If you're going to design a data center, rather than designing this huge enclosed campus that requires all of the environmental stuff, all of the power, all of the parking, everything else, just basically design a huge parking lot, and you can start putting these containers in there link them up. As your needs grow, just place an order for another container. It's very flexible, very expandable, and much lower cost when compared to traditional methods for building data centers. I mean, your application is exactly right, and that's very exciting, but that's just a small part of what the vendors see their customers doing with these new containerized data centers.
Absolutely. T-Bird, I want to throw over to you because you actually have experience, and let's geek out a little bit, with these containerized data centers. You want to share with the Twilight Riot what you were doing way back when?
Actually, I wish I could show a picture of my actual comm van that I had in some real interesting places. But the best I can do right now is to steal an image from the NCIS LA red team. So if Jason can go bring up a picture of Laverne and Shirley. The concept is 240-foot trailers that the sides will open up and create a floor and a ceiling. And if we can go to the next one, the inside turned into a nice big giant conference room. Now, obviously, this is a Hollywood set. My comm truck was only half of Laverne and Shirley. I only had one, but I did have a little bump out, just like bump outs on RVs. And that popped out, and that was my bunk bed. I also had a kitchen and all that kind of good stuff. The concept was we needed a way of getting high-end communications into trouble spots very quickly so that I could provide communications to our NATO partners. So data centers like this have been around for a very, very long time. American Power Conversion has one, Sun has one, you name it. Now, I will say one of the largest I've ever been to was actually in the Frankfurt airport. They basically took over a section of a large parking garage, and instead of having to do a real roof, all they had to do was bring in various pieces and containers and set up a very large data center that could expand and contract as necessary. And then they would just take the power and cooling off the airport infrastructure. Very reasonable, very cost-effective, and the Frankfurt people said the payback on that particular data center was very, very short on the terms of perhaps as little as 5 years.
Well, there you have it, folks. The future is the Uber Geek RV. Now, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more to our panelists, but first, I wanted to bring in the third sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and of course, that is TechServe. We talk enterprise. That's what we love. That's what we want to do. And we know that Apple has become a big part of the enterprise, especially in BYOD. We see more tablets. We see more MacBooks. And we need to be able to support them, which is why I'm happy that TechServe is part of the Twilight Riot. As New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe carries a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe also has a range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the U.S., whether you're already committed to iPads or just getting started, from sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. Some amazing technology solutions are being deployed on iPads right now. If you've been to the Delta terminals in LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, and those are all showing up on screen right now, you may have noticed nearly every seat in the terminal is equipped with an iPad. Travelers can now sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on their iPad, or use them to store, to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting for their flight. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer service satisfaction scores in all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company behind Delta's terminals. They've turned to TechServe to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads, a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechServe really was the natural place to turn. They sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects, from the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechServe is able to do full lifecycle management for all your technology needs by providing the devices that you need, getting them up and running, teaching you and your staff how to effectively use them, and managing them so that they're working efficiently. TechServe also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise has a problem, help is never further than a phone call away. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most experienced partner? So here's what I'd like you to do. If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit techserve.com/try it, and TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's techserve.com/Twyatt. techserve.com/Twyatt. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, you've gone and done it. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. I want to thank my panelists, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Tell me and tell the Twyatt Riot, what are you working on? Where can they find you? What are the cool Uber Geek things that they need to know about?
Well, I finally got the new gig pipe online for the Aloha Cabled Observatory, and I'm getting ready to light up a Real Networks Helix DNA server so that upwards of 1,000 simultaneous people can watch the deep ocean fishies and listen to the hydrophones. Just as soon as it's up and live, I will broadcast out the URL to the Twyatt Riot.
Disclaimer, though, we are not responsible for any hours that you waste watching the fishies, because it is actually pretty mesmerizing. Over to you, Curtis. What's going on at Enterprise Efficiency? You actually run a very stellar series of interviews and discussions that I think everyone in the enterprise should listen to. Tell us what's coming up and where can they find you?
Well, this week and next week, we do have a whole bunch of great interviews coming up. Starting Wednesday of this week, we've got Rich Santaleza, who is chairman of the American Bar Association Subcommittee on Social Media and the Law. We're going to be talking about what the legal aspects of social media are for the IT professional. Later this week, we begin a series of interviews with the people who will be speaking in the conference at Interop. That continues through next week, leading up to the beginning of Interop, where we're hoping to have a show featuring you, Padre, telling us what is exciting and new right there from the Network Operations Center in the Jacob Javits Center. So a lot of great radio coming up. We hope that people will join us at enterpriseefficiency.com.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, Chiebert. And you know what? Thank you. That's right, you, the listener, the viewer, the person who downloads our podcast or watches us live. Because if it wasn't for you, we wouldn't be able to do this show, which we love doing. And so, you know what? I want to give you a little something for all the time and energy you put into watching This Week in Enterprise Tech. That is to give you a way to get every episode of Twyatt Goodness downloaded onto your device of choice every single week, automatically. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/Twyatt, you'll find a drop-down menu that will give you all the different ways you can get the stream, to get the podcast, the netcast, onto your iPad, onto your iPhone, your Android device, the phone or the tablet, even your Zune, your zombie Zune. You have it. We'll give it to you just because we love you. Also, you could check us out on our Twyatt YouTube page at youtube.com/Twyatt. There you'll be able to find not just all of our episodes, but also the individual segments that we run during the show. The data closet, stuff my IT guy says, things that you can watch in a playlist. You know, it's actually how I spend most of my weeks listening to myself. That actually sounds really, really strange, and that's totally not true. But it should be true for you. Also, you can follow me on Twitter if you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ. And if you follow me, you'll actually be able to tell me what you want to see in future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's where we get many of our topics. When we know that our audience wants to do it, well, we'll just find a way to do it. Finally, you can watch the show live every Monday. That's right. We're here in Petaluma in the studio broadcasting at noon Pacific time. If you watch us live, you'll be able to see all the stuff that doesn't make it into the final cut. You'll see how we set up the show. You'll see the bloopers. You'll see what goes on at the end. It's just part of our Twit experience. And you know what else is part of the Twit experience? The chat room. You may have heard several times I call out to people in the chat room, and that's because our chat room at irc.twit.tv is filled with some absolutely brilliant engineers, with some funny, funny trolls, and just with people who love the Twit experiment, the experiment in temporary community. I want to thank everyone here at the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Carson, my super producer, and to Jason who, wait, Jason, I'm getting breaking news here. That you actually run an award-winning podcast about Android.
We won an award? I had no idea about this.
What
award?
Yeah, it's
go ahead, tell
the
me.
Padre Award.
Oh, okay. Well, it's an honor to win the Padre Award. You can find this award-winning show called All About Android at twit.tv/AAA. Records every Tuesday. In fact, got a lot of interesting Android news working for tomorrow's show, so check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Stay tuned to the Twit TV stream because we bring you the best in tech news and instruction. I'm Father Robert Ballester. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.